Welcome to Tom and Lorenzo's Pop Style Opinion Fest.
We're here to render judgment on the worlds of celebrity, pop culture, television, and fashion.
Strap yourselves in for some hardcore opinionating, darlings.
This is Tom and Lorenzo's Pop Style Opinion Fest.
We're Tom and Lorenzo.
And this is the Pop Style Opinion Fest. Hello, kittens. Welcome back to another edition of the PSO. I am the T in your T-Lo, Tom Fitzgerald. I'm here with the Lou in your T-Lo, Lorenzo Marquez, my lovely husband.
Hello.
We're back after a week away.
Yes.
Sorry, but we just had to take care of some stuff last Friday, and we could not do a podcast. But we're back. We missed you. We hope you missed us.
Yes.
We have to get caught up on the last two episodes of Drag Race UK, which we will do at the end of this, you know, at the second half of this
to avoid spoilers
podcast after the break, to give you, you know, people who don't want to be spoiled on stuff room. But it is a all TV, I think. Yes,
yeah,
it's another all TV episode of the Pop Style Opinion Fest. We Lorenzo has quite a few TV things.
It's been a TV explosion.
But before we get to your little TV obsessions, I want to look back for a second because we got the honor today.
Oh, it was very sweet.
The AV Club, who, oh my God, we've been reading the AV Club since it first launched. They did the 100 best, worst, and weirdest things we saw on the internet in the 2010s, and we made number 25, and hopefully, I believe it's not because we were the weirdest, but the best, according to the write-up. We made 25 on the list for our Mad Style series, looking at the costume design of Mad Men. And I know I've read comments out there from people who think we are just hold ourselves in obnoxiously high regard because this was such a successful feature, but I don't care. I'm allowed to be proud of something that we did that is everything okay?
Yeah, fine.
Okay. My husband is also our technical whiz kid, so he's like checking mics and levels at the same time he's, you know, talking about TV shows. But anyway, Mad Style, yes. It's one of those areas of our career as bloggers where I am just unapologetic, like, yeah, we did a fantastic job on that. Not only that, but we actually changed television criticism. We changed how people approach television criticism. And I am not the one saying that. I am the one quoting the many television critics, and some of them quite high level, who have said that about the work over the years. Matt Zoller Seitz from New York Magazine wrote a book on Mad Men, and we are cited in the chat in one of the chapters as creating a new form of television criticism, creating something that no one had ever seen before. So yes, I accept the applause and I am fine with, do you not agree, Lorenzo?
No,
you're very
agree.
Quiet
I agree.
Through this.
I agree. I was busy doing the post, you know, putting the post together, and I hadn't seen the tweet about it. And then when I read the tweet, I actually choked up a little because
And we should shout out to Allison Wilmore.
Yes.
Or Allison Shoemaker. I'm sorry. Allison Shoemaker, who wrote the piece for us on the AV Club and said the nicest things about us.
Right, because I wasn't expecting it, and I got very emotional about it because ever since we started the blog, the whole idea of creating the blog, the site, was to come up with something different that wasn't out there.
Right.
And the Mad Men was one of those ideas because we absolutely love costumes. We've always loved costumes in movies and TV shows and so on. And Mad Men was one of those great things out there on television and
right.
had the most beautiful costumes and actually had a story through the costumes. So we've designed by Janie Bryan, of course, you know, and she did such a phenomenal job. And so we felt like, all right, this is something we can do. And I remember talking to you about it and the subject matter and everything. It was just so much what we like to do and we appreciate.
Right. It was all the things that we were most passionate about.
Yes.
And had them I have always shied away from saying experts, but we had a large knowledge base for things like 60s fashion and 60s advertising and the 60s as a decade.
Right.
We knew a lot more than, say, the average person.
And with everything we do, it started with the idea of just like picking the best costumes of the show. And then it kept growing and growing and growing. We're like, all right, then we need to do this. Then we need to do that. Then we need to include this actress, this actor. And it kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Finally, we were like, all right, then we have to do it by episode now. And it is. It's so much joy. We get so many compliments to this day. We still, when readers meet us or we talk to people in general, they always mention Mad Men.
I had an interesting reaction this morning to that article and that mention. It was very, very touching to be on a list like that, like greatest of the decade, and actually to place 25 on a list of 100.
Right.
That's very, we're honored. We are very honored and grateful for it. And it did make me stop and really think about Mad Style, because I haven't really thought about it much in recent years. I don't know, but I think I may have admitted this on the podcast once before, but
I think you have.
That, yeah, my Mad Style is difficult for me to go back mm-hmm. to in a lot of ways for two reasons. One of which is my mother was dying of stage 4 lung cancer the final weeks of the series, and she died a few weeks after the series ended. And we had to write all these posts about Betty and her lung cancer and really examine like lung cancer as a theme and that stuff and everything. And so, you know, that was undoubtedly hard. And
not only that, tell the story about your mother working in New York. That's the whole idea.
Well, yes, there's that as well. I mean, we started Mad Men, Mad Style. We became so obsessed with the show because my mother's name was Peggy, and she was a good Catholic girl from an outer borough in New York who went into the city and worked in a high rise as a secretary after going to secretarial school. So when the first episode launched, I was like, oh my God,
right?
That's my mother. Now, of course, Peggy Olson's story is the way it went off in directions that had nothing to do with my mother. But she was the initial reason the show became, you know, we became so enamored with the show, and then she died right after the show ended. So, Lorenzo's adjusting my, oh,
I
making
know.
A mess.
Things are Lorenzo complicated today. Go ahead.
Falling apart.
Sorry, go ahead.
Is everything okay?
Yeah, everything is fine.
Okay, we're recording?
Yes, okay. We are.
I was just having a moment here, and Lorenzo stepped all over it. No. But the other thing is that Mad Style was the most intense blogging experience I've ever had. In the sense that after the first couple seasons of us doing it, it became this red hot ticket, and it was widely written about, and everybody was linked. I mean, one I still think back on this is the, you know, public intellectual and author Chuck Klosterman actually linked to one of our Mad Styles one time and called it brilliant. And I was like, oh my God, when do you get to, you know?
Right.
I wouldn't say the guy's my hero, but I really look up to his writing and I think he's brilliant. So it's like, wow, that, you know, and there were other people. So what happens is when you're writing a series like that, that gets very, very popular and much discussed amongst the most influential people, let's say, who are online or on social media, you are getting attention, and it's crazy attention. And, you know, there is a subset, and it's not even a subset. I would say in this day and age, it's probably the main part of online television audiences who take any writing about their TV shows on a very, very personal level. And if you step one micron outside of their own opinions about the show, especially a show like Mad Men, which touched on such very touchy theme. Like, I mean, it touched on misogyny and rape and racism and anti-Semitism and all of the, and the characters weren't perfect. There were no like angelically good characters or demonically bad characters. It was all shades of gray. So when you're getting in there and you're analyzing people and analyzing their motives and how things are played out in the costume design and everything like that, people would take stuff extremely personally. Like, for instance, it was a running theme with the character of Peggy, as opposed to the character of Joan, that Peggy was not an excitingly beautiful girl, the kind of girl that turned men's heads. That was written into the show, that was written into the character, that was written into how she dressed. But if you were to mention that, then there was a ton of people who would come down hard on you because they thought you were saying Elizabeth Moss was ugly. That sort of thing. Where it's like, no, this is the show. I'm trying to analyze what the show is doing. I am not making judgments about the people. Because first off, they're not actually people, they're characters.
Right.
So that level of attention was incredibly, incredibly hard to take sometimes. Mm-hmm. And it was paired with early on, we really dazzled a few critics who mentioned it in their reviews. I remember two things. The Joan motif of roses in the episode where her husband leaves her, I think. And there's this continuing motif of roses, and we explained it. And it was very eye-opening to people who didn't notice that she was wearing roses all the time. And the second one was Michael Ginsberg, who was the copywriter, who was this wisecracking New York Jew. And we noted very early on, way, way before the show even indicated it was an issue, that we thought that he might have, that the character might have mental health issues, going entirely by the way he was dressed and certain things that he said, if you took them a certain way. The reasoning behind that was because his outfits were not just messy, but extremely oversized, as if he couldn't handle too much stimulation. And you will see that a lot of times with people who have certain sorts of mental health issues. So we noted that, and very early on. In fact, we noted it several seasons before Michael actually did have his breakdown. And it was two seasons of people calling us anti-Semites because of it, like screaming at us in the comment section because they thought we were saying, like, and again and again and again, they were like, no, he's just a New York Jew. This is how we talk. We're funny, blah, blah, blah. He just dresses like a schmuck. He's a schlemiel. And I'm like, yeah, I don't think... You know, you can't really have these arguments, but I was like, yeah, I don't really think that that's what's going on here. Anyway, so but both of those predictions or those observations turned out to be true and rather easy to understand. Like when they unfolded, it was like, wow, Tom and Lorenzo really got that one right. And we got this reputation as if we were trying to crack the code of the show and make predictions about the show. And from that point on till the end of Mad Style, and even to this day, if I stumble across some thread about Mad Style, someone will bring up, yeah, but half of their predictions were wrong. And I was like, yeah, the point wasn't to predict. That wasn't what we were doing. It was literary analysis. It was taking the text every week and pulling it apart as much as possible to find meaning in it. Not everybody gets or enjoys that sort of thing. A lot of people read that and they think it's navel gazing and you're talking out your ass, and fine, you know, fair, whatever. Don't read the things you don't want to read.
Right.
But it always was a viable form of critical analysis, and it was never meant to predict where the show was going to go.
I think the experience with Mad Men was that it became so big on the internet that it literally wasn't in our hands anymore. And it just took off. And
that's true of RuPaul's Drag Race,
right, and
Project
people,
Runway.
People just ran with it and reinterpreted any way possible, which that's how it works.
Right.
My comparison here, like with a painting or whatever, or a book, whatever form of art out there, people have different reactions. People have different experiences, and it was tough sometimes because. There was the whole conversation about, oh, well, they just talk about colors. And then it became an obsession with colors.
Right.
Which was one part of our analysis, but wasn't the whole thing.
It was also
silhouette
and
style. It was
style.
An amazing experience. It was great to do it. We appreciate every minute of it.
But we wouldn't do it again?
No, we wouldn't do it again. It was so much work. I remember, I'm not joking, putting the recaps together, putting the... collages and all the montages, you know, like all the pictures together. It was so much work. It would take us 4 hours just to put the pictures together, and then another 2 or 3 hours or more for you to write.
Well, to write on that level, I watched, by the time I wrote Mad Style for that episode, I had seen the episode 4 times.
Right. It was a lot.
And the episodes aired on Sunday, and Mad Style, I think, usually went up on Wednesday or Thursday. So I would basically have to watch it every day until the day, you know, over and over again to pick up on, you know, voluminous notes. Listen, we loved it. We loved it. We loved the critical acclaim. We loved doing it. We loved stretching our analysis muscles that way. But as blogging, as a form of blogging, it wasn't viable. It was not viable from a business sense because you are turning literally all of your energy over to one post and then the rest of it suffers. And we knew this because we were like, okay. And then we also knew that the audience was leaving. We knew that once the show ended, the massive audience that read Mad Style wasn't really going to stick around for our red carpet stuff. So, you know, As Mad Style was winding down, we really were ramping things up in terms of other content, celebrity content, mm-hmm. television reviews, movie reviews. Our first book came out. All of that was in response, actually, to Mad Style and knowing that we were not going to be able to sustain that level of intensity on our blog, and we were going to have to find other outlets. So, and actually, this podcast was part of the decision. You can't spend 20 hours a week on one post mm-hmm. if you are a business, if you are a publication.
Right.
I'm thrilled we have that library there. I'm aware certain people some people have contacted us that because we have moved from server to server, a lot of the pictures are missing.
But it's an enormous amount of work to put them together, but I am working on putting them together. So at some point, all the pictures are going to be back, and we're going to have them there on our site.
We get, every once in a while, we'll get an email asking or pointing this out to us that the pictures on Mad Style aren't loading. And we also get semi-regular emails asking why they can't read all our Project Runway posts right. from the past, you know, from literally 10 seasons, you know, 10 years ago, 12 years ago. And the fact remains, people, it's a painful truth, is that TomandLorenzo.com is a business and everything has to keep moving forward. Devoting too much time to maintaining your archives, which really don't generate that many views, you know, a 13-year-old Project Runway recap is not getting views, and to take like an hour or two trying to get the pictures back up on that it's just not worth it. Most sites, and it's very true, most sites over time, they just let their archives waste away.
They do, which is
maintaining an archive, there is right. no money in it, and it's a ton of effort. And listen, we're here 13 years later, and we're not going anywhere, even though everybody, sometimes it feels like every other site is failing left and right. So we have to be in the moment. We have to be forward facing. As mm-hmm. much as I would love to rest on Mad Style's laurels for the rest of my career, it's just, I can't. I love it. I love that it's thought of so well. And I will say, getting a plug in here, I've said this many times in discussion about our upcoming book, but writing Legendary Children, which is the title of our upcoming book, was the first time since Mad Style that I felt like, wow, we are really flexing those muscles in that mm-hmm. way, mm-hmm. diving deep on a topic we know really well
right.
and analyzing the shit out of it. And I don't just mean Drag Race. I mean, we analyzed 100 years of queer history. So if a plug here, if you did love Mad Style, even if you don't know Drag Race or you're unfamiliar, especially if you're unfamiliar with queer history, if you really loved that writing and what we brought to that discussion, I'm telling you, our book, Legendary Children, The First Decade of RuPaul's Drag Race and the Last Century of Queer Life, is available for pre-order, and it will scratch that Mad Style itch for you. Okay. Before we move on, we really must give a shout out to Joybird, who is sponsoring this portion of the podcast. With Joybird, your personal one-of-a-kind style should match your furniture. Bring your mood boards to life with hundreds of customizable pieces and over 50 fabric options. It doesn't matter if you're more of a neutral beige or a bubblegum pink person. If you can dream it, Joybird can build it. And I'll stop right there and say we have had custom furniture made, and I cannot recommend it. I mean, it's so much better than going into a showroom and buying something that everyone else in your neighborhood might have. The ability to go in and make those choices at the design level means you get a piece that reflects you, reflects your home perfectly. You're not shoving something into your home and trying to make it work. It doesn't matter if you're a neutral beige or a bubblegum pink person. Did I already read that part? I think I did. If you can dream it, Joybird can build it. Need a sofa in a golden hue or a love seat in the hottest red, an inviting baby blue, or even a plush green velvet? Joybird's got your back. From rich buttery leathers to the softest velvets you've ever felt, you're sure to find the fabric and texture that's right for you. Joybird offers a range of kid and pet-friendly upholstery options so that your creations can stand the test of time and the wrath of your furry friends and toddlers. And there are free fabric swatch kits available to let you see and touch all of Joybird's fabrics and help you make the perfect choice. And there's free personal design consultants to help you go from inspiration to creation. It's quality handcrafted furniture. Each Joybird produced piece is made with the ultimate care and precision, using real wood without all those harmful chemicals and responsibly sourced materials. All Joybird handcrafted pieces come with a lifetime limited warranty, and there's a 365-day home trial. Skip the furniture store and bring the showroom home. Sit on it, sleep on it, and break it in. If you don't love your Joybird, return it. There are free returns within 2 weeks of delivery. Joybird stands by its quality and craftsmanship. If it's not everything you hoped and dreamed for, send it back. To create furniture that matches your own fearless style and to receive an exclusive offer for 25% off your first order, go to Joybird, joybird.com/Lorenzo, LORENZO. That's joybird.com/Lorenzo and receive an exclusive offer for 25% off your first order by using the code Lorenzo. Thank you, Joybird.
So just one more thing about Mad Men that I want to say, that I'm one of the things I like about our Mad Men legacy is that we get so many mails and we talk to so many people now talking about how much they pay attention to costumes now and how much they appreciate costumes in general.
TV criticism and TV analysis now regularly includes costume analysis in a way it did not 10 years ago. And I will stand on my... Yes, I will stand up and say that we had something to do with that. That I've heard too many critics say over and over and over again. I mean, Allison, who wrote the piece on us, said she learned, you know, we taught her more how to be a critic. She learned more about being a critic reading our stuff. I know it was influential, and I'm very, very, very proud of that. No, it didn't get every prediction right, because that was not the point of it. But anyway, now... I am going to be uncharacteristically quiet because Lorenzo has several TV shows he wants to talk about. Oh, I should also mention that when Lorenzo is done, we are going to give a non-spoiler preview review of season 3 of The Crown. The embargo has been lifted. We're going to give you some of our very excited thoughts about the season. We will not give away one plot point. We're just going to talk about the actors, the look, the feel of the show. You will find out which characters get introduced this season. Like, we're going to talk about the actress who played, say, Princess Anne, but we're not going to go into anything about her storylines, just so you know that. But for now, I'm turning the mic over to Lorenzo. Go.
On Netflix, I mentioned it before, there's a show called The End of the Fucking World, and that's the title, on Netflix, and season 2 just dropped, and I talked about the show a little bit. I really like the show. It's a fun show. It's not for everybody. It's a road trip kind of show with two teenagers. They are amazing. The actors are really, really amazing. Jessica Barden and Alex Lawther. They're very, very good. They have amazing chemistry. And it's just a fun, weird, that kind of British, you know, kind of dark humor. But they're so good. I mean, they're teenagers, you know, they're young actors, but they're so good. They're so good together. And it's just one of those shows that, you know, there's not a lot of action. There's not a lot of stuff going on really fast to keep your attention. But if you like those road trips where it's about people discovering things and coming to terms with things and that type of story, you're really, really going to like it. Season 2 is just as good. They added a few new characters, and it's still fun. So I highly recommend it. It's available on Netflix. Go check it out. It might not be for you, but give it a try. The other show that I've been watching, we got screeners, and I kind of watched a couple of episodes ahead of time. It's a new show on HBO called Mrs. Fletcher. It's actually based on a book. Starring
Catherine Hahn, who we love.
Starring Catherine Hahn, and she's phenomenal. The thing with this show, I just want to point out that, you know, she tends to play these crazy female characters or like not very, kind of like out of the norm type of female characters.
Extreme characters.
Yeah, characters, and I love them all, and I think she's a great actress. And what I like about the show is that she has a chance to be a little more than just what she usually plays, which is some funny, quirky, you know, crazy character. This is actually a very interesting role. It's a story of these 46-year-old divorcee who her only child is heading to college, and she has to deal with the idea that her only son is going to college, and then she's by herself, and you know, she pretty much has to rethink her life from that point on. Again, it's based on a book, and she's really good. It's a little slow every now and then, but it gets better, and she is really, really good. And it's funny because we don't have kids, but we have relatives, we have family members who are going through this right now, the whole idea of having their kids go to college. And it's funny because I watch them talk about it, and it's not something that I can directly relate to, but it's interesting to see that sort of like adjustment that you have to make in your life.
Yeah.
And this is a great show about it. It's on HBO called Mrs. Fletcher with Catherine Hahn, and she's really, really good. So give it a shot.
It's Lorenzo recommended.
I know. I do recommend it.
People love Lorenzo's recommendations.
Yeah, they kind of do.
They do.
And, you know, you don't have to love everything that I'm sure that, you know, I'm talking about something here and then you give it a shot and it's not for you, which is fine. That's what I do when I'm on Netflix too. You know, I give it a try and I give it a shot. And I mentioned that once here on our podcast that people tend to just read the description of something and move on. Oh, I don't like it. No. Sometimes the way they describe a show or a movie, especially on Netflix, it's not always that great. So just play it for 5 minutes. Play it for 10 minutes. I usually give it like 15 minutes, and if I don't like it, I turn it off. Same thing on HBO. So those are great. And Catherine the Great is also good. We're so busy. We have so much going on. I only watched the first episode of Catherine the Great with Helen Mirren.
I didn't like it.
Tom didn't like it. I didn't love it. But the costumes and the sets are insane. If nothing else, watch it for the costumes and the sets. They are absolutely beautiful. So we might have something on the costumes. I'm not promised anything. We'll see, right? Mm-hmm. But those are my recommendations for now. Give it a try.
This concludes Lorenzo's TV recommendations. Thank you, Lorenzo. Now let's talk about The Crown.
Oh, yes, 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 yes.
Like I said, we're not spoiling any plot or any episodes. People want to know about the new cast, and we're here to talk expressly and exclusively about that. I'll start off by saying this. First, it's a great season. I watched the whole season. I can't imagine if you loved those first two seasons, unless you were so in love with that cast that you can't let go of them, I can't imagine why you wouldn't love this season. It is The Crown. It is the same show, the same sets, the same musical cues, the same style, and the same focus that the first two seasons had, but it's an entirely different cast. And playing the same character. So it is kind of an interesting experiment. The first couple episodes of the season actually lean into the idea that they look different. The opening scene, which was, they've released it as a preview, has Olivia Colman looking at the new postage stamp with the older version of herself on it next to the one with Claire Foy on it. And so it's an opening discussion about, and that is the theme of the series, of the season, which is that she is, and Philip, are in middle age through most of the story, that they have settled down, that their marital issues are completely solved. There are no marital issues between Philip and Elizabeth. That's mm-hmm. not their focus. That doesn't mean they've dropped out of the story, not at all. Elizabeth and Philip are still the main focus of the season through most of the season. The final few episodes of the season are far more forward and next generation looking. And we'll get into the casting of Princess Anne and Prince Charles in a bit. And, oh, Camilla. There's a Camilla sighting this season. But Olivia Colman, let's start with her. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Yes.
Yeah. Why don't you give me your thoughts? Because I think mine are a little more complicated. Go ahead.
Mine are a little complicated too. But let me just say in general, I think, I don't know if it's because I read more about the stuff that they're covering season two, but for me, I actually love season two more than I love season two. Than season two, I'm sorry.
You love season three?
Two, I'm sorry. Season three more than two and one, actually. Sorry.
Okay.
That's the latest season. Let me put it this way. I think it's my favorite. I think it's because I read more about the stuff they're covering. So I kind of can relate more to the subject matter,
right,
in each episode. But the music, I think the music is everything about it.
There is some really stunning musical.
There is some music. The music is stunning. Right.
Yeah. That I really do think. I can't remember who the composer is. I don't know if I ever knew who the composer was. But whoever they are, they really stepped up their game for season three. We are also getting into the 1960s and the 1970s. So the fashion is changing. Not too drastically, because this is the royal family. They don't go out and embrace all the trends, except for maybe Princess Margaret. But even that is slightly tamped down. Helena Bonham Carter plays her. All right, let's start with Olivia Colman. I love her. Love her as an actress. I thought the casting was perfect. And I thought she... Well, she's played queens before, not just in The Favorite, but she has played the queen mother. So... I thought we were good to go. The thing is, and maybe I'm being influenced by the fact that Olivia Colman actually mentioned this in an interview, that the hardest thing for her in playing Elizabeth was that she Olivia Colman herself is so expressive and emotive in her face. And they kept telling her to tamp it down. Like, I know she said at one point they were shooting a scene. I won't give away what the scene was, but I do know which scene it was, where she had to listen to these, you know, very sad stories. And they had to put an earbud in her ear and make her listen to the weather report so she wouldn't cry on camera listening to the other actors tell these sad stories. Because the whole point of that scene is that Elizabeth doesn't cry. So it's a slight problem in her portrayal, especially after Claire Foy's two seasons. I mean, the brilliance of Claire Foy's portrayal is, first off, she got you to completely look past the fact that she looks like a movie star way more than Elizabeth ever did. She didn't really resemble Elizabeth. But she got you to get past all that because she really nailed Elizabeth's personality as we know it. Of course, I don't know the queen, but as we know her to be this stern, stoic, sturdy figure in her life, and all the way back to her youth. So Claire Foy was very good at that. She was very, very good at having these micro expressions play across her face, where you knew what she was thinking as Elizabeth, but you could also respect that Elizabeth was trying to keep complete control over her face. There's not a lot of that in Claire Foy, in Olivia Colman's portrayal, which, again, I must add, I do actually really love her portrayal and completely fell in love with it by the end of the season. But I will mention, just maybe to prep you a little bit, the first couple episodes, I was like, all right, this is a new Elizabeth. This is definitely a different take on Elizabeth. And it's notable to me in some ways because when you watch all the other actors step into their roles, most of them are kind of tipping their hats to the previous actor who played the role. Tobias Mingus, who actually is, I'll tell you right now, much better as Prince Philip than Matt Smith was. And Matt Smith was good. Tobias is better, maybe because he's playing the middle-aged Philip, and that's so much more recognizable to us than the young, horny Philip. But it's also very clear that he's basing part of his vocalization and the way he carries himself. He is basing some of that on Matt Smith. Same thing with Helena Bonham Carter, who it took me a couple of, well, maybe it took me the length of her first episode where I was like, why is she speaking in that weirdly deep voice? And then I remembered because Vanessa Kirby, who played Margaret in the first two seasons, has a deep voice. So it's stuff like that where you can see that people are working to maintain a certain level of continuity. And I'm not suggesting that Olivia Colman, there's a lot that she does that bridges the gap between her and Claire Foy that make you believe her as Elizabeth and that make you believe that she's the same Elizabeth you've been watching the last two seasons. There is a scene with Charles where I'm like, there she is. That's that cold Elizabeth that Claire Foy was so good at. And in the scene, it's a scene with the adult Charles and they're not getting along. Which is, everyone knows that about their history. He and his mother they tussled a lot, especially when he was younger. And she refers to a scene from season one about her grandmother, Queen Mary. And when she was in that moment being all stern with Charles and then making you remember a scene from season one that Claire Foy played, it felt perfectly meshed. And this comes later in the season where I feel like Coleman probably got a better handle on the character. And I really don't want this to sound like criticism. It's more like it's an interesting thing to observe a very good actress step into a role and take some time to get to the point where it, you feel like the performance is seamless. It's never a bad performance. It's just that there are times in the beginning of the season where it's jarring how different she is from Claire Foy. I'm sorry, I'm dominating again.
No, that's fine. In terms of Olivia Colman, I think the thing is that I love her so much. I think she's such a phenomenal actress. But I and maybe because I didn't know much about Claire Foy when she started performing the role of the Queen, I don't know. I didn't know much about her career, about her previous work. So to me, every single scene, all the time, I saw the Queen and not Claire Foy. And I don't feel that way about Olivia Colman. Most of the time I see Olivia Colman doing a very good job and not necessarily the Queen.
I think that's fair. It's not for lack of it being it's not a bad performance. It's a very good one. She will probably get nominated for an Emmy, but, you're right. You see way more of the actress. Olivia Colman's very expressive. She has this enormously broad smile. Her eyes fill up with tears at the slightest emotion. It makes for a great actress, but it doesn't always make for the best Queen Elizabeth.
And there's something about, Claire Foy being more poised, I think, or stern. It's just the performance was a little more... I don't know. She had a more stiff personality or characterization of the Queen.
Yeah. Coleman almost plays the Queen as a little insecure at times, which is kind of a Coleman trait. But I'm like, that's not what I got out of Claire Foy's performance. Like, she stumbled her way, especially when she was very young in the role. But by the end of season two, she was a figure of confidence. She had accepted who and what she was. So when you see Olivia Colman, especially in the first few episodes, sort of like coming off a little insecure, making these little asides and grinning a lot, it's like, okay, we need to get that part under control.
Right. But having said all that, it's a phenomenal performance.
It really truly is. And she made me cry more than once.
Yeah, she's great in it.
She is.
And if you're a fan, you're going to love her.
Helena Bonham Carter, very jarring because physically she's absolutely nothing like Vanessa Kirby. And to be honest, she's not really that much like Princess Margaret. It's more, we're just going to put this actress in here because we love her. They doll her up in wigs and makeup and 60s mod clothing, and she's fun to look at. I won't take anything away from her performance. It's very, very good. I don't feel like she was utilized to her best throughout the season.
I was just about to say that.
She got one or two episodes that really showcased her, and the rest of the time she felt very sidelined.
Yeah, so just be patient, because that's the same reaction I had. I was like, where is she? Why isn't she?
She gets a big story near the end.
They don't use her a lot in the beginning, but then she shows up more.
Yeah.
And there's a whole great episode about her. So she has more parts. Have more parts towards the, middle of the show.
The end. I think one of the more interesting recastings, which I guess sort of slipped under my radar. I may have heard that Derek Jacobi was playing the Duke of Windsor. I think I may have heard that somewhere, but I had no idea Geraldine Chaplin was playing Wallis Simpson. And I gasped when she appeared on screen, because first off, she looked exactly like her. And so you and I both were like, is that Geraldine Chaplin? Oh my God, that's such good casting.
Right.
She's not huge in the season, but she does get a couple really good scenes and a couple really good lines. Derek Jacobi is very good, but he is very different. Oh my goodness, I can't remember the actor who did such an amazing job as the Duke of Windsor in the previous two seasons. But it's a different take. I guess partially because he's playing a very, very old version of the character at the end of his life. So he's allowed to play him differently. But he's good. I definitely want to talk about Prince Charles.
Yes.
Because I know you're such a huge, huge, huge fan of
him. I'm a huge fan of the actor. Yeah.
But I also know you're a huge fan of your Casetify phone case. Casetify is the world's slimmest, most protective phone case. With tons of classic design, stylish collaborations, and the ability to create your own custom case, Casetify lets you keep your phone safe without sacrificing style. Why is Casetify so awesome? Military-grade drop protection. Casetify cases have a two-layer Chi-Tech material construction and have passed the drop test from a height of 6.6 feet. The style statement, with thousands of designs to choose from, you'll find the perfect case for your aesthetic. And there are custom cases. You're able to choose your favorite designs, colorways, and add custom text to create a custom phone case no one else will have. Lorenzo, go.
Yes, it's absolutely phenomenal. Listen, I'm very picky about my phone cases. Had horrible stories that I already mentioned to you guys with previous, you know, brands that didn't work. But they are amazing. And the minute I saw it, the minute I got the case, I knew it was the best case, highest quality, and it looks beautiful, and you can customize it however you want. One of ours has actually Tilo on the back.
I know, and it's a Tilo branded case,
and it looks adorable. So they're fun. You can do whatever you want, pick whatever color you want, write whatever you want on the back. And they are very, very, very sturdy. They're like the best quality. It's pretty much the best case I've ever had.
Casetify often collaborates with artists and designers. Past collaborations include Saint Laurent, Pokemon, Sarah Jessica Parker, DHL, Wonder Woman, and the Rolling Stones. So go to Casetify.com. That's Casetify. Casetify.com/TLO to get 20% off your purchase. That's Casetify.com/TLO to get 20% off your first purchase. Thank you, Casetify. Okay, Josh O'Connor is playing Prince Charles in season 3 of The Crown. I feel like he was cast solely because he's got two big ears that stick out. He's an entirely too sexy and too cute Prince Charles, but I believe he was absolutely excellent in the role.
I agree.
Voice down completely. If you close your eyes, he sounded just like Prince Charles.
Yeah, I didn't know much about the actor when it was announced that he was going to play Prince Charles. I was very excited about it because, like I said, I didn't know much about him, but he's in one of my, probably my the most favorite movie, a gay theme movie called God's Own Country. And if you haven't seen it, go see it, go watch it. On Netflix, I think it's still available on Netflix. It's one of the best movies I've ever watched, gay theme movies. And he's in it, and he's absolutely phenomenal. He's so good that I spent a lot of time researching, trying to find out who he was. And he's done other stuff, great stuff. And people know him from other stuff that he's done. But anyway, so I'm very excited for him. I'm excited to see that he's going to get so much exposure because The Crown is very, very, you know, it's a big show. A lot of people watch it. And he's good. He's one of those actors that I read interviews with him when he did God's Own Country. He did a lot of research. He lived on a farm for a while to get the character right. So he's one of those actors that he really study his character. Does a lot of research, and you can tell playing when he plays Prince Charles. You know, you can tell that he embodies that. Yes, you're right. He's way too pretty to play the part, but he gets everything down.
He does. There are times when he plays Charles, and you feel that he's very charming.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think Charles is or was the most charming person in the world, but you can see a certain level of charm in the portrayal, and as well as there is a certain level of the character is really annoying. The show doesn't shy away from the fact that Charles, because of his upbringing, is socially awkward. Having said that, Charles isn't featured too heavily, and neither is Princess Anne. They both get notable scenes and notable episodes, but you can tell that they will be much more focused on those characters in season 4. Diana, I'm telling you right now, is not introduced. Camilla is, and much of the groundwork of their future relationship is hinted at or implied or set up. But I did say to Lorenzo, I was like, "Ooh, I have a feeling they're season four is going to be controversial because the way they set up Charles in season three, they're so sympathetic to how hard Charles's life was and how confused and awkward a man he was, that I feel like they're going to cast Diana as much more volatile and harder to take. You know, the whole throwing herself down the stairs thing and everything like that. It seems to me that there's a lot of groundwork laid for a very, very sympathetic portrayal of Charles cheating on Diana, and possibly a portrayal of Diana that's harsher than one we've seen portrayed on film.
We'll see.
I mean, there are stories. There's plenty of stories. Not that I'm trying to sugarcoat Charles, but there are a lot of stories about how difficult Diana was and the mental health issues Diana faced and how that, you know, was kind of a nightmare for her family. And I probably just the way season three plays out, the themes that it touches on and everything like that, I'm like, yeah, that is probably going to be what season four is all about.
Right.
The nightmare of Diana. We'll see how that plays out. Now, Erin Dougherty, we have to do a side discussion.
Yes, absolutely.
She doesn't get enough scenes, but I say that because she's so damn good in the role as Princess Anne. She's probably my favorite new portrayal of the season because, when she first shows up, now she's playing like the 20-year-old, you know, circa 1970 Princess Anne. And when she first shows up, she kind of takes your breath away because, oh my God, she looks exactly like her.
I actually went and Googled all those pictures and I'm like, oh my God.
They really nailed this one.
Looks the hair, makeup, everything.
And she gives this extremely dry, snooty performance that is a clear take on both Matt Smith and Tobias Mingus's version of Prince Philip. She talks. There's a fantastic scene with her and Philip. I think it's when you first meet her, where it's so clear that she's her father's daughter,
right.
Which I thought was interesting because maybe that's true at the time when she was a young woman, but I know now that she's a mature woman and the queen is advanced elderly age, they're extremely close. Like, she's really close with Prince, more closer to her than she is with Prince Charles. And you don't really get that this season. It's more about her and Prince Philip, which is fine. But she does a tremendous job. She really is... she kind of, actually, in a funny way, she reminds me a lot of Vanessa Kirby as Princess Margaret.
Right. She's so good that every time she was in a scene, I kind of like cheered.
She was just great.
She's so good.
And in the few scenes that she actually had with Olivia Colman, they actually did play off each other very well. And I will say this about Olivia Colman, as opposed to Claire Foy, she's not averse to playing the comedy inherent in The Queen. She's not averse to making The Queen look a little comical. Claire was all about a more dignified portrayal, and Olivia, because she is pretty much a natural comedian, and also because, you know, a lot of the season is about this middle-aged, very tightly wound, repressed woman dealing with a very changing Britain. So she gets to be flustered way more than Claire Foy ever was, and there's certain comedy in that. One final thing I want to note, I'm going to put it out here now. I'm going to make this prediction. I think Jason Watkins, who is playing Prime Minister Harold Wilson, is going to walk away with BAFTA and Emmy nominations. I'm not all that familiar with him. He's a character actor in Great Britain. I have seen maybe caught a few things that he's been in. I recognized his face and name, recognized his voice as soon as he opened his mouth. But wow, what a nuanced performance.
Amazing.
The things he does with no dialogue are just amazing. And the character, I don't think any character in season three goes through such an obvious arc.
The last time you see him
in the season, he has changed so much from the first time you've seen him in the season.
Right.
Next to Erin Dougherty, my favorite performance this season, and I wasn't expecting it at all. First off, I don't know much of anything about Harold Wilson. If you'd asked me anything about Harold Wilson prior to this, watching this season, I would have been like, well, I know Monty Python mentioned him a couple of times. Like, that's it. I didn't really know much. And I didn't have a lot of expectations, but he really blew me away with a performance that was at times very funny to watch and at other times so tender. And at other times, so tense. Like, he really brought the whole full range of a man to this performance. And of course, he was helped by some very good writing. So that's it,
I think, for The Crown. I think it's a phenomenal season. Some episodes are absolutely brilliant. They're going to make you cry your eyes out.
It's a fantastic season.
Everything is. I thought everything was beautiful. The cinematography, the music, the way the close-ups, the way the camera works. We talked about this. It's just beautiful. Everything is beautiful. It's by far my favorite season.
A++ from Tilo. Yes. We will be doing episodic breakdowns, looking at the costumes, talking about the themes as soon as the season drops on the 17th, I believe it is.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it. We're going to take a short break. And then we're doing a super quick run through of the last two episodes of Drag Race, which we will not spoil the endings of either of them because of the crazy way Drag Race UK is airing.
I know, it's crazy.
We'll be right back.
Talking celebrities, pop culture, TV, and fashion. This is Tom and Lorenzo's Pop Style Opinion Fest.
Kittens, we're back on the Opinion Fest, and we're going to sort of zoom our way through the last two episodes of Drag Race UK. Probably not doing them both the service they deserve, but we will be doing written recaps of both. Tomorrow, the girl groups recap will go up in the morning because that episode airs tonight. And then next Saturday, the what was the next challenge?
The
water bottle challenge, which aired last night in the UK and will air in the US. We're going to do both of those now. We're going to kind of run through them because we had to unfortunately skip a podcast last episode. So, singing challenges on Drag Race, they have a long history. We have an entire chapter of our upcoming book devoted to nothing but the singing challenges, and they always break down in two ways. There's two reactions to them. There's the queens who can sing, who are really well suited to the material, who have complete meltdowns because they can feel the pressure that they have to step up. And then there are the queens who can't sing, and they have complete meltdowns because, well, they can't sing. It produces perfect reality television drama, and in typical Drag Race style, the judges tend to get really excited, not if your performance was technically perfect, but if you did something really brave or overcame your fears or just sold it, irrespective of your talent level. So,
yeah,
that's me running down the themes. So, any general thoughts about this episode?
Well, thoughts about this episode. It was exciting to see the first reading as the mini challenge.
Oh, that's right, the library mini challenge.
The library.
Yes, those queens were a little vicious.
And it was awesome. And again, with everything they do, I'm always curious to see the British take, the European take, you know, a different take on every challenge that we've been watching for so many times.
Right.
So when RuPaul announced the reading, the library reading, I was like, yeah, phenomenal. I just want to see it. And it was funny. It was really, really funny. And they were vicious sometimes.
It was one of the best reading sessions I've seen in a couple of seasons,
I think.
So that
was good. That was very good.
Yeah.
And in terms of singing, listen, after we did so much research, and Tom did a lot of research for the book, our book, I changed my mind about so many things. And one of the things, I used to hate the sketches and all these things. But now, with all the research we did and you know, the book and everything, there's such, to me, there's a, I don't know. I see things a little different. And so all that sloppiness, all this, awkwardness that you see throughout these sketches and challenges and everything, I actually appreciate them
that
now.
That is built
more
into the challenge.
Yes, yes.
And it's also built into a certain style of drag,
a certain
style of sloppy, uncomfortable, a certain performing style.
Right, because I have a tendency to like everything perfect.
Right,
And this is not it.
Yeah, drag isn't always that. It may be about perfection in your looks.
Right.
But the performance style of drag, whether we're talking about singing, dancing, or theatrical performances, acting, there is a tradition in drag of doing that, especially in British drag, of doing that in a broadly comedic way, of doing it in a sort of a pantomime-y sort of way. And that includes a certain level of sloppiness in the performance. If Rue wanted perfect pop star performances, well, then that would be one of the casting criteria every season, all 10 girls would have perfect voices. That's not what they want.
So that's
they want a super draggy performance, and they want it funny and loud and bold. Okay, I'm sorry.
So I thought, when RuPaul announced the challenge, I was like, here we go again. But I actually liked it. I thought it was funny. I thought they were very talented singing and performing, especially Beggars Group.
Right. The first group was Filth Harmony.
Right. And they were great, but not perfect or not perfect. You know what I mean?
It wasn't phenomenal. The surprising thing was, again, we're not giving away top or bottom or who lip synced at the end. We're just going to generally rate a few of the performances. This happens. One of the queens who is really talented, she choked. And it was the Vivian who just didn't sell anything in the number the way you would expect the Vivian to sell it. Cheryl Hole had a real great moment to shine because girl groups are apparently her whole thing. But Filth Harmony was, you know, it was okay.
It started really strong, as the judge said.
And then it just fizzled out.
It fizzled out and it just faded away. And towards the end, we were just like, all right, you're doing an okay job.
Their looks don't have anything to do with each other. I mean, they're all wearing patent leather thigh-high boots and body stockings, to be fair. But I mean, body suits, to be fair. But they still don't look coordinated at all.
Right.
And there's no sense. It's not that a girl group actually has to all come out in the same outfit or whatever. But if you're doing a challenge and it's a drag challenge and the challenge is girl group, yeah, I would suggest coordinating on some level, which is how the Frock Destroyers did it. And I thought they were a much more believable and polished girl group. And that had Bag of Chips in it and Davina DeCampo and Blue Hydrangea. And Davina DeCampo and her whistle tone was impressive as hell. Bag of Chips, impressive as hell.
Were great. I mean, the judges were laughing the whole time. And,
yeah.
You know, that's right there. You know they're going to be, they're going to like them better. And they were funny. The lines were funny. Bag's fun lines were hysterical.
And Davina rapping.
Right.
I was like, oh my
yes,
God.
Yes.
Davina's been bringing the drama in both this episode and the next episode. There's this elevating drama with Davina and her, insecurity in the face of some of these other queens. It is very clear that Davina is extremely talented and has a ton of experience. She's been doing drag for something like 15 years and singing, dancing, comedy, the whole nine yards. But she feels, I think Baga and the Vivian are so cocky and young and talented, like they have the goods to back it up, that they're really screwing with Davina's mm-hmm. head. It's a class of like mind fuck. I don't know how much they're doing it on purpose. I love every one of these queens. Honestly, I do. This is the least, there are no villains, you know, and there's no one here that's really getting on my nerves, but the Viv and Baga are obnoxious. There's no denying the way they are in the workroom, the way they talk about the other girls. And again, this is not a church social. These are drag queens. They can all handle it. So I'm not like clutching my pearls about how rude the Viv and Baga are. But there are times when I'm like, okay, you do need to shut up. You're kind of obnoxious. And
right. You're
not as good as you're saying you are. So Davina's had moments in the past two episodes to step up and really show that she is actually a world-class drag queen. I don't think I want to say anything else about that episode. It airs tonight on Logo,
right.
And we will have a written recap tomorrow with a link to this podcast in case you want to hear our thoughts.
But it was a great episode, as usual. As you said, it keeps getting harder and harder to see these queens go home because I do like all of them.
Yeah.
I think they're great. And so, yeah, but I love it. I really, really like the British.
I am really enjoying this season. I really like each of the queens for bringing something a little different. Maybe it's a different bit of insecurity or a different bit of cockiness, a different accent, a different flavor. But
they're just funny. Like Blue not knowing, I don't know if she really didn't know what a rant boy was.
Which I find that really hard to believe.
I find that hard to believe, but it was funny the moment when she said, what's a rant boy?
The following episode, the mini challenge was they put the Brit crew to tremendously good use this
time. Of course, as they should.
Freaking cute, man. That is a cute-ass collection.
I know.
Of quiet, oiled-up studs. But they had to guess what kind of underwear they were wearing. So there was a lot of loving close-ups on their massive cock ring enhanced bulges. Come on, every single one of those dudes was wearing a cock ring.
Of course. I mean,
I just want to step in once again to plug the book and let you know that there is an entire chapter on the Pit Crew entitled "For Every Tuck, There Must Come a Bulge." So I could sit here and talk all day about the influences on the pit crew and what how they represent queer history, but I won't, because that's why you'll buy the book. Anyway, this challenge was a lot of fun. That little hairy dude with the beard is my freaking favorite.
I know.
Favorite.
You're in
he's
love with
charming,
him. Charming. Yes, you're in love with
and
him.
And he's twerking. He's smiling in every scene. And
you come always
on,
talk
he's
about
got that
how
hot
hard.
Little body. I ain't got no problem
he's,
with that.
I have to say, he's the hottest, but I also like Big Ben.
He's too tall and skinny for me. I just don't. It's not my thing.
Anyway.
He is cute, though.
They're yeah.
Anyway, so the challenge, we're sitting here staring at crotches and losing control of this podcast, but the challenge this week was to do to write an ad for bottled water. And once again, if you ever wonder why the hell does a Drag Race competition do these things where they have to do like advertisements, Rue's early career, she made history by being the Viva Glam girl for MAC right. Cosmetics. Rue has a history of being a spokesmodel, and the entire Drag Race franchise, people forget this when they get on the show, you know, they really rag on Drag Race for redefining drag or for being very narrow in its scope. That is the point, is that it is all based on RuPaul. It's all based on RuPaul's career, RuPaul's vision of drag.
Right. So they had to come up with a name, via packaging, and then create a commercial for the product.
Yes. And the results are, well, we are at the end stage now. We are at the top five queens. So all five queens are extremely good. And even the bad ads. I don't know how close I want to get into what they did, because then we're really we're mentioning who got eliminated.
Confusing. It's confusing. We can't name. We can't talk much about each one individually, because if we don't talk about one, then you know that that person was eliminated. It's
but I mean, we've already. That's
anyway. In general, the commercials were okay. Some were better.
Some were hilarious. But even the bad ones were okay.
Right. And the category for the runway was what was it? Rainy Day Eleganza.
I just want to stop though, and mention that Katya makes an appearance.
Yes,
was very fun. And first off, she looked amazing. I think she wore that when we saw her on tour. I think she wore those boots.
Yes.
But she's there to give Davina a pep talk. And I don't know if they knew each other ahead of time, but they sure acted like they were old friends. And it was just a really cute, fun scene. And I could sit and watch Katya any freaking time.
Oh, my God. Katya's so funny.
Yeah. Davina really has won me over.
Right. I agree.
She is really funny. She can get a little insecure. But of all the queens there, she is the most honest about her feelings. There's not a lot of fronting with Davina. She's very honest about every insecure or cocky thing she's feeling.
And I think Davina has some kind of like the same humor, same type of humor.
I think she and Katya are similar.
Yeah, Katya's very inappropriate.
And
very inappropriate.
Well, I feel like Katya, I don't think I'm talking out of turn. Katya's been open about her struggles. Katya has used drag to overcome certain struggles and insecurities in her own life. And I feel like Davina's largely the same way.
Right.
Like recognizes like. Right. And Davina talked about growing up under, what is it, Section 28, being a school child and not being able to mention homosexuality. So that was a very interesting look at British homophobia and how it played out for certain people. And because Davina's slightly older than, she's 35, she's not old, but she's slightly older than some of the other queens, she does have that perspective.
And I think the thing with her is that she talks about how talented she is, and she doesn't understand why she's not winning everything and all that. There's a big bit about that. And
I'm kind of with her on that.
But I think it goes back to what we said before, that it is important that you're talented, that sometimes some of these queens have done a lot of stuff for television and everything.
Right.
But it doesn't, that's the typical case of like being on the show, and sometimes you have to do something a little different or to sort of like reorganize your talent or your skills a little bit.
Right.
To make the judge like you or pay attention to you. I don't think just being talented is enough for a competition like this.
No.
Plenty of super talented queens. And I think she needs to understand that a little bit.
Yeah.
She thinks that just because she's talented, she speaks several languages and does a lot of other things, that's enough.
It's not.
But it's not enough for a competition.
Having said that, I have a top three in mind, and I think it's kind of obvious who the top three are going to be.
Yeah.
And Devine is one of them. And I am switching my allegiance because I'm starting to think I would rather have Devine win it.
Oh, my God, no.
I know no. You want Bagga to win.
I want Bagga to win.
I would not cry if Bagga won. I think out of the top three, the likely top three, the one I'm least interested in winning is the Vivian. Maybe because she's so cocky.
Mm-hmm.
I do like the Viv, but I also don't think her drag is always that great. I think every once in a while, and this week, for this challenge, her runway look, which was this rain-based category, her runway look was amazing. She can do this high art drag, but her other form, like the pop star, when she was in the girl group last week, I kind of thought she looked like shit.
I thought the Vivian looked amazing. It was an amazing look, but I didn't think was the right look for the category.
Anyway, I mean, there's an argument to be made about whether she's getting so far away from drag that she's really just in costume design and prosthetics at that point. But I do. I like the Viv. I really like Bagga, and I really like Devine. If any of them won, I would consider it a rightful win, but of the three of them,
mm-hmm.
Viv's my least favorite. To me, it would be a showdown between Bagga and Devine, but I know if they really wanted drama, the best showdown would be between the Vivian and Devine.
I agree.
But they'll probably do a showdown between Vivian and Bagga because they're friends.
They're front runners. I know. I like so many of them. I love Blue. There's so many.
Yeah.
I love a ton of... I mean, they're all funny. And I don't know, I guess because she's from Ireland.
I do think we've reached the point that every elimination from here on out is going to hurt a little bit.
I think so, because there's just five now.
Yeah.
You know, it's so, and like I said, I've watched so many seasons, and most of them I like everybody and I enjoy what they do. But when they go, I'm not that upset about
it. Right.
But this crowd, yeah, I'm like,
week,
oh my God,
that went
yes,
home
yes,
all
was of
upsetting.
Them.
And, well, no.
Last week, the same thing. Yes.
It wasn't upsetting.
Well, kind of. I don't want to give too much away, but...
Except to say that with Drag Race UK, more than a lot of other seasons, it was very easy to figure out who was going home in what order from the first episode. Like, literally, they're ticking people off in exactly the order I would expect them to. That's all I'll say about that. I think it's one of those seasons... And it's not the first time Drag Race has had seasons like this, where the final three was pretty much decided before the season started.
Right.
I'm not accusing anybody of anything. That's just the way reality competitions work. And you can tell sort of in the casting which queens were going to go earliest.
Right.
So that's all I'll say about that. Funny thing about Cheryl Hole, they finally showed... The pop singer Cheryl, who inspired her, her former name was Cheryl Cole, and I'm like, I don't see it at all. I know she's basing her on a 10-year-old version, like the character's based on when she was in that Girls Aloud group.
Right.
But even then, I went and Googled all these pictures, and I'm like, she never really looked like Cheryl Cole. She never looked like that.
Right.
So I guess, I don't know, is it more of a conceptual take on the character? She's not actually impersonating the character.
Yeah, I've been doing a lot of Googling with this show, with this season.
Which is fun.
Because you know, they mention people that I never heard of,
right,
or I don't know too much about them, and I just keep Googling and finding out more about them.
Yeah. I think that's it, because if we get any further, we're going to start spoiling.
Right,
but,
that's true.
The spoilers are for the written recaps, which go up on Saturday mornings, kittens. And I think we're going to end it here.
Yes.
So thank you for sitting in on more of our TV talk. And we'll be back next week with more opinions on everything that passes in front of our eyes. Love you. Bye-bye.
Love you. Bye.